Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. You're about to meet a fascinating man who was once known as DJ Cool Carl. He is Dr. Carl Hart, now an associate professor in the Department of Psychology and Psychiatry at Columbia University. His own story is very powerful, and his studies of drugs and addiction will open your eyes and show you that the war on some drugs is even more misguided than you might have thought. That's straight ahead. First, my thanks to the individuals who subscribe to this podcast, including Bob Getzla, Bill Lackemacher, Andy Krieger, and Bob Donjacour. You can join their ranks. Just go to my homepage, peterbcollins.com, and follow the sign-up link right under my picture. Subscriptions, $5 a month, or the best deal, $50 a year, and I appreciate your support. The other way you can help us out is by clicking on the link with this podcast and going to audible.com, where they feature more than 150,000 audiobooks for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. And if you follow that link, you can sign up today for a free 30-day trial. Won't cost you anything. And your first audiobook is free. The benefit? Well, audible.com will pay me $15 for each trial membership. So it's a no-risk, no-cost way that you can kick in $15 to support this podcast and get a free audiobook in the process. There's an easy link in the show file, there's the banner ad on the homepage, or if you're just listening and don't want to go to my website, click on audibletrial.com/Peter B. Collins. That's audibletrial.com/Peter B. Collins. I sure got a lot out of this new book called High Price by Professor Carl Hart, including a new appreciation for Gil Scott-Heron.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from the Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised.
That's a powerful piece that many people know. The revolution will not be televised. And ironically, it was television that introduced me to Carl Hart. I saw him on Bill Maher's show on HBO back about 6 or 8 weeks ago, got a copy of the book and read every page. And Carl Hart, I feel like I know you. This is a book of deep revelation, and it must have been difficult for you. You're very honest and self-critical.
Yeah, well, that means I accomplished my goal. Actually, you know, I felt like this would be my one shot in order to have the ear of the United States. And so I figured I had to go all out. And that's why I told this deeply personal story.
So if you'll indulge me, I found a Gil Scott-Heron song that really fits a lot of the description of your personal story. And it's called On Coming From a Broken Home. Here's a little taste of that.
I want to make this a special tribute to a family that contradicts the concepts, heard the rules but wouldn't accept, and women folk raised me and I was full grown before I knew I came from a broken home. Since I lived with my grandma down south, Where my uncle was leaving and my grandfather had just left for heaven, they said. And as every ologist would certainly note, I had no strong male figure, right? But Lily Scott was absolutely not your mail order, room service, typecast black grandmother. I was moved in with her, temporarily, just until things were patched.
So let me stop Gil Scott-Heron's telling of his story there. And as I say, yours has some interesting similarities. Your book opens with a description of some brutal fights that your parents had, one that sent your mom to the hospital. Then your parents split up and you were sent to live with relatives, including for a while your grandmother. So your interest in Gil Scott-Heron, musically, also kind of parallels biographically.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of difficult to listen to you play that piece by Gil Scott-Heron, because when that album was released, I got invited here in New York to attend a listening party, which he was going to be there, and I had to do something for the National Institute on Drug Abuse, so I couldn't make it, and then he died shortly thereafter. So it's bittersweet to hear you talk about Gil Scott.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I just want to tell people, I use an internet service called RDO, R-D-I-O, and they have an incredible catalog of Gil Scott-Heron's tunes. And I'm not shilling for them, but they only charge $5 a month for access to all this music. And as I was reading your book, I put on a lot of different songs and spoken word pieces from Gil Scott-Heron that I wasn't familiar with before your book. So it's just another reason why I'm pleased that I watched the show and then got the book and read it, Carl.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that, because the piece that you played here recently, that was one of his more recent pieces.
Yeah.
But the thing that really got me into Gil Scott-Heron was his sort of critical analysis of the political environment in the United States, particularly as it related to the 1970s and the 1980s. And it was a time when I was starting to develop my own sort of critical thinking skills.
Yeah. Whitey on the Moon. One of his most powerful pieces in my recollection.
Yeah, and now, you know, a similar sort of thing can be said about Whitey in Iraq or in Afghanistan and those sorts of things. So the bottom line is that we spend a large amount of money on the means for outside of the United States when we have people suffering in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Before we get into your own childhood story, I was really struck toward the end of the book. You described the scene where you're at your grandmother's funeral and you meet one of your children for the first time. Tell us about Tobias and how difficult that whole experience was for you.
Well, Tobias was a kid that was conceived when I was 15, and I didn't know anything about it. I had left home a couple of years later and was never told about it. And then I was told about it when he was about 16, 17, I don't know. I was notified by the courts while I was living in New York. He was living in Florida, and I thought it couldn't be real because I would have known. But sure enough, the genetic test and that sort of thing proved that I was the father. And so I had a lot of mixed emotions, because he was being raised in an environment, one in which I had thought that I had did well by escaping, and at least I had avoided having children outside of wedlock, and I was wrong. And so I had all kinds of emotions about what he must have gone through, what he was going through. Now I'm responsible for this person who I had no role in shaping who they became in life. And I'm still struggling with it today. In fact, he and I just got off the phone right before you called.
Oh, really? How's he doing?
He's doing his best. He's had a hard life, as I describe in the book. But he's a decent person, kind-hearted person, but he's struggling.
And it's beyond ironic, Professor, that you're an academic who escaped, and we'll get into your past in a moment, but some of the pathologies, some of the patterns that develop affect you as well. And I think that makes you a real person, not someone to be judged or criticized for it. And so as you talk about Tobias, and here, you know, you're a nationally recognized professor and an expert on drugs, and this son who you learned about, fairly late in his development, has been a street level drug dealer, and so these factors are things that are very much a part of our society. And even though, you know, you have a very powerful story of personal change, that there's some things that we can't change and that we can't control.
Yeah, but there's a lot we can control because, you described Tobias being a street-level drug dealer. I, too, was a street-level drug dealer.
Yeah.
And so I think that there are things that we can do, structural things in our society that will encourage people to change, help people to change, various types of programs that fell out of favor during the Reagan era and those sorts of things. And
mm-hmm.
So I think that it would be a mistake if people conclude that there are just some things we just can't change. Psychology, science, we have quite a bit of knowledge about behavioral change, but the country, that's just not the priorities of the country right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, we're still in this strong father punishment mode, and the rates of incarceration, the human and financial costs of all of that, are really starting to be recognized by many people, but it's a slow process. And the knee-jerk reaction that if someone's doing drugs, we should lock them up is still very strong. And the Nancy Reagan mentality is deeply ingrained in my son's generation. He's just approaching 30 now.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. But I think that your son's generation and younger generations are seeing through the hypocrisy a lot more than the generations before them, excepting for the 1960s, young people in the 1960s, where they were questioning everything. But I think today's generation, we're seeing a resurgence of the questioning, I think. I think that's why we're in this moment where people are receptive and they can hear, they can listen, they can read my book and be open, whereas just the generation before, it was really difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And let's talk now about your own history, and you describe it deeply in the book. One of the things that struck me as a white guy is that in your family, you were considered one of the darkest skinned, and there was, internal discrimination about that. You and your sister, describe that, please.
Yeah, this is what the thing that you're describing is, for example, in a black family in the United States, as well as other countries. I'll get in that in a second. In the United States, the darker you are, in some places, you are more vilified. You're looked upon as not being as attractive. A wide range of sort of negative attributes are associated with you as a result. But that's not uncommon for other South American countries as well. A similar sort of thing exists when we think about the Dominican Republic and Haiti. They share an island, but the Haitians are vilified. In
yeah.
fact, if you're born in Dominican Republic with Haitian descent, you can still be deported. You're not a Dominican citizen, in part because of the skin tone. So that's not unusual, but it certainly happened in our family. But we have to understand why these things happen. It happened mainly because of the view of the dominant culture. In our society, we're taught that white is right. I mean, in multiple ways in a young child's life, if they are black, they are told that their life is not worth as much as a white child's life. From our television commercials to our movies to our elected officials, it is insidious. And
yeah.
so this is just an extension of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think it's enlightening for people like me to learn that, because I've never been exposed to it and wasn't aware of that. So talk a little bit about the women who stepped in, because after your parents split up, your mom went away for a while to try to make some money and sent you to grandma, and you lived with an aunt. Talk a little bit about the way many people like you from broken homes grow up with various parent figures.
Yeah, were not for the women in my life. I had five older sisters, and I had a grandmother who was quite doting, my paternal grandmother. I never really wanted to let them down too much. And so even though I engaged in petty crime and sold a little drugs and skipped school, did those sorts of things, I knew I couldn't stray too far off the beaten path because I would ultimately have to answer to those women who I knew cared about me. They made sure that I had money in my pocket. They made sure that I presented myself as best I could. And I didn't want to let them down too much. And so that helped me to not run amok. And so I credit much of my success to those women.
Now, one of the things that's interesting about your story is we see a lot of emphasis on pro athletes as role models. And basketball really was a way forward for you. It gave you something to do. It kind of kept you, it appears, away from gangs and heavy involvement with drug selling or drug using. And so talk a little bit about that, because often there's criticism of these, you know, millionaire superstars who lead lives that aren't perfect role models. And also the impact on young children in urban environments who think that they're going to be the next big basketball star.
Yeah, those athletes get a lot of unfair criticism, in part because they are quite young. But I'll talk a little bit about how athletics, basketball specifically, really helped me to get to the next level. Basketball, high school basketball, in combination with my sisters and my grandmother, it really kept me plugged in. In order to stay on the basketball team, you have to maintain a C or a 2.0 GPA, grade point average, which is not that high, but it was high enough to ensure that you could graduate. You could graduate with a 2.0 grade point average. So if I wanted to stay on the basketball team, I had to maintain this grade point average, which I did. So I stayed on the basketball team. I was a star. I thought I was going to get a basketball scholarship, but that sort of carrot to be on the basketball team kept me plugged in the mainstream as well. When I didn't get the basketball scholarship that I thought I should get, I decided to go into the Air Force because of a guidance counselor who didn't want to see me fail. And so she really encouraged me to go into the Air Force where I could continue to play basketball, where I did play basketball for the Air Force teams overseas.
And talk about that, because, number one, you know, coming from your background, it's kind of unusual that you would join the Air Force. You might think of the Marine Corps, the Army, or in some cases, the Navy. Why did you choose the Air Force? And was it more than a job and the adventure that, or is that the Navy? I don't remember whose commercial that is.
The Navy was the adventure, but they all are adventures, really. I chose the Air Force in the book I described because one reason was because they had the blue uniforms as opposed to the Army green, which I could not see myself in Army green. That's one of the reasons. But another reason was because the Air Force required that you have the highest entry exam score, and so I wanted to be in the group that I thought was the smartest. And so those were the main reasons.
And you didn't do that well in school, but you shined in math. And it seems that really helped kind of salvage your early academic career or record.
Yeah, I did really well in math early in high school, especially because math didn't require one to have or to use the English language. Coming from where I came, we didn't speak mainstream English that well. In part, this is part legacy of Southern slavery and so forth, but. Mm-hmm. I didn't know this as a kid, and so my vocabulary was limited, and it was embarrassing to speak when you know that something about your speech, your language, is insufficient compared to other kids, compared to the teacher. And so when it came to things like English history, it would which relied heavily on verbal behavior, I just would not speak as much because I was embarrassed. Whereas with math, all you had to do was show that you could do the problem, you could solve the problem. And since I was good at athletics, basketball and football, throughout my life, you always needed numbers to calculate statistics, the stats of various players that you liked, your own stats. And so it was just constant practice with math, and I didn't need the English language for that.
Now, you spent some time in the Bay Area. Were you here when the Oakland School District started to plan to teach Ebonics as Black English as an alternative to Standard English?
Yeah, I was there. I was in the Bay Area during that time.
Yeah.
I think that people got it confused and twisted. I think that the Oakland School Board was trying to make sure that people were aware of what I just said. Like, I grew up in a community in which mainstream English just wasn't that good because of the legacy of slavery and various reasons. And so now that I'm a doctor, for example, when I see research participants, there are people who speak, who don't speak mainstream English, and they say things like, my nerves are bad, or something of that nature. All of the doctors who I work with, white, mainstream sort of people, they all know what that means. That means that there's this sort of generalized anxiety. Ebonics is like a similar sort of thing. It's just being able to meet people where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was blown way out of proportion.
Oh, yeah, I agree. And I think that you really offer us a prime example of someone who, you know, people can hear you. They know how articulate you are. Your book is extremely well written. And while you occasionally will quote some street slang or black talk, you know, you very clearly have moved on from that. And in a later chapter, you even admit that creates problems with you staying in contact with your family members because they think you're an effete elite academic snob.
Yeah, you run the risk of being seen as a traitor. And, you know, I understand where that comes from, and even though my feelings get hurt sometimes, but I completely get it. I mean, we know of people like Clarence Thomas. I mean, not to pick on Clarence Thomas, but...
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, he's just a great symbol of someone who just sold out his people. And so you don't want to be seen that way based on the way you use language in a casual, informal setting. And then people may think that you think that you're better than them. You are trying to show them up. And that's... You really don't want to do that. So I have to be cognizant of that. And I think if we would be a better country if more people were cognizant of that sort of thing.
Now, the Air Force stationed you in England, and you took some courses there. Was that kind of a shocking transition? Because, of course, they speak even a different kind of English than I do.
I think one of the things that I try to describe in the book well is that my time in England, I spent about 3 years in England, it was the most rewarding educational experience I think I've had because the British, even though, like you said, they have their way of speaking English, they saw me as an American first, and so the pressure was off, and they were willing to corroborate my reality in America in terms of the racism and the poor race relations. So in Britain at the time, this was shortly before apartheid ended, and there was a lot of pressure on the South African government. There was even pressure or a lot of talk about the U.S. racism on their television program. So it was the first time in my life where I saw this sort of official government or in mainstream society acknowledgement of poor race relations in the United States today. What I was going through at the moment, even today in this country with our black president, we are loathe to really talk about this issue of poor race relations and racial discrimination that happens throughout our society.
Now, you have matriculated in a lot of places, in England, University of Maryland, University of North Carolina, but the most unusual was your work there on your PhD at the University of Wyoming. As a self-described dreadlocked guy with three gold teeth and very dark skin, you must have really stood out in Dick Cheney's Wyoming.
Well, I should tell you, I enjoy being in Dick Cheney's Wyoming a hell of a lot more than I enjoy being in Jesse Helms' North Carolina. So I had just left from North Carolina when I moved to Wyoming. Wyoming don't have, I mean, I guess it's less than 500,000 people in the whole state. And then in the town that I lived in, Laramie, where the university is located, there is about 25,000 people there, and maybe 100 people there, and they're all at the university. 100 black people there, and they're all at the university. And so the black folks who were in that town were there because they were doing things, like they were athletic stars, they were some academic star. And so people kind of understood that if you're in Wyoming and you're black, you must be somebody special, and you were treated like an individual as opposed to a member of a group. And so that was freeing, liberating.
Interesting. I've only been to Laramie once. I went to the rodeo, and I do recall it was an all-white crowd, and all the cowboys were white, too. So it was a while back, though. It was in the 60s.
This is an important point that you're raising, because in America, the thing that people don't understand that it's not about the conspicuous color of white people. It's about the conspicuous atmosphere, environment that's been created that's white. Because in New York, where I'm living, it can be as conspicuously white as Wyoming, even though we're really diverse. But when we think about what's happening with our police officers, for example, I will get stopped by a police officer in New York City because those are the people who are getting stopped. So that, even though those police officers are Latino and black in some cases, but it's still the attitudes, the sort of pervasiveness in the environment, the milieu is white. And so people think that because Wyoming is just the faces of the people who occupy those spaces are white, that it's really white. It's not necessarily true. New York and certainly North Carolina can be as white or even whiter than Wyoming.
Well, and the stop and frisk program in New York is extremely insidious. And yet I hear people talk about how they feel safer because people of color are being stopped and frisked in record numbers. Only about 4% of them, I think, actually result in any kind of an investigation or a citation. So I find it remarkable, that gap between the law enforcement efficiency of stop and frisk, which is, you know, off the charts negative, to the perception of the average white, and let me say tourist as well, coming to New York thinking, oh, man, I feel safer because of these programs.
I think that people are right in that New York City is one of the safest cities. I mean, when you look at the statistics, clearly that's right. But the problem is if they are attributing their safety to stop and frisk, then we're in trouble. That's a logical error. We're in New York City. We have, you know, we're a very small geographical space, but we have about 40,000 police officers. And the next sort of largest police force is L.A., which is so much bigger than New York, and they have only 15,000 police officers. And so when you have 40,000 police officers, particularly where tourists go, most of them are where the tourists go in Times Square, where there isn't much crime, yeah, of course it's going to be one of the safest cities. But the stop and frisk is happening in places where the tourists do not go.
Yeah.
And so I think that people get it twisted, and I think that our mayor has played a role in confusing or in confounding the issue. But the bottom line with the stop and frisk thing is that if you have a disproportionate number of minorities being deleteriously impacted, affected by policy, we call that racist. But nobody's calling this mayor a racist, and he is because he's supporting this policy.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking for people with wearing the white sheets and using the word nigger, but those people, they're rare these days. The racists look like our mayor.
Well, and they had to give him a third term. Just I never understood that either. We're talking with Dr. Carl Hart. His powerful new book is called High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery that Challenges Everything You Know About Drugs and Society. And interwoven with Carl Hart's personal story is very accessible information about what we know about drugs and how wrong most of it is. And let me start with the most astounding piece here, and that is the relative addictive nature of crack cocaine. Because the average person who's never used crack thinks that if they smoke it once, that they will be immediately addicted to it and that their lives will be ruined. They'll sell everything, spend the rent money, and just, you know, take the fastest route to the poorhouse possible. But your scientific studies show that crack is not nearly as addictive as is widespread belief.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And we've known this for some time. Not only my studies, other people have known this. One of the studies that has generated a lot of interest recently is a study that we did more than a decade ago where we invited, we had crack cocaine users, these people who are addicted to crack cocaine, come into the lab, and we gave them a choice between a nice hit of crack cocaine or $5 in cash to see whether or not when these people were under the influence of crack cocaine, they take a sample hit of the dose of cocaine that was available, would they be able to make rational choices about drug or money if they have an opportunity to choose either? And they certainly were. On about half of the occasion, they chose the $5, and about on the other half of the occasion, they chose crack cocaine. And so it shows that these folks were behaving rationally. But if you increase the money to something like $20 per hit of a drug, they will never take the drug. They take the $20. That's what rational people would do.
And we're not rational about drug policy in this country. And as you explore in the book, I do give credit to the Congress and to President Obama for rolling back the extremely draconian penalties for crack as compared to powder cocaine. But while you do touch on the Len Bias episode in your book, I would have been a little more pointed about a single individual named Joe Biden, who's currently the Vice President of the United States,
right,
because
he
led the hysterical charge to ramp up the penalties for crack cocaine with those extreme minimum mandatory sentences. And I don't believe I've ever heard Joe Biden backtrack from that, acknowledge the racist implementation of the policy that he championed, and I didn't see him as one of the leaders to reform it.
I'm with you. You're absolutely right. And I was remiss by not calling Joe Biden out on this, in part because there are so many things to deal with in the book. But you're absolutely right.
And so how can we learn from that experience? Because, you know, tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of mostly African-American, mostly males were sent to prison. Some of them are still locked up. Some of them are in the cycle of parole, no job, back to prison. And the real scourge of crack cocaine were the policies that emerged from it and the failure to acknowledge Mike Webb's deep reporting on how the CIA facilitated the importation of cocaine and the development of crack as a second product back in the 1980s.
So your question is, how do we move beyond that?
And how do we learn from that? Because in a moment I want to talk about methamphetamine. And we, once again, have policies that are driven by hysterical, non-scientific bases, and we're about to repeat this cycle in some ways.
Yeah, you said a lot of things there. How do we learn from it? And when you said Mike, it's Gary Webb, right? The guy, the
Thank
reporter.
Thank you. Yes, Gary Webb.
Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the things that I'm trying to make sure we do is not repeat the same mistakes by having people call for tough sentences for drug-related violations. That I'm trying to show people the error in our logic in the ways that we've gone about this. And I'm trying to show people that this is how we were bamboozled previously. Let's avoid being bamboozled in that this way again. And so I think one of the chapters of my book is called The New Crack, and I'm talking about methamphetamine to show people that the hysteria that's being said about methamphetamine is identical to what was being said about crack cocaine. And you see where that led us, and you see how wrong we were. We now notice in science. And I'm trying to show the public how science participated in the misleading of the public. So I hope that I was at least partially successful.
Well, you really opened my mind, Professor, because I've been captive to the same media reporting about methamphetamine. And anecdotally, you know, I have relatives or friends of family members who I've seen get caught up in it. And, you know, they got these weird nodules and rashes that they feature on their hands, sometimes on their faces. So it is kind of scary, but you have undemonized it. Please explain to our listeners the similar chemical structure of amphetamine, which is the active ingredient in Adderall, which is a widely prescribed drug for ADHD, and the chemical structure of methamphetamine.
Yeah, so when we think of amphetamine, which is the active ingredient in Adderall, Adderall, of course, is a drug that people take for attention deficit disorder and also just to stay awake and alert to help them study longer. They are almost identical. There's just a methyl group added to methamphetamine. But when we tested these two drugs together in people under double-blind conditions, they produced identical effects. Other people have also found this sort of thing, other researchers. And so they are basically the same drug. And when you think of that, that we don't talk about people having Adderall mouth or getting crazy on Adderall, why are we saying people are getting crazy on methamphetamine? Consider also John F. Kennedy, the president who we are now celebrating after the 50th year of his assassination. He used to receive injections of amphetamine while he was the president, so he can be alert, he can be have energy. We also use amphetamines for our military, particularly for our pilots who are working extended hours, and they use them safely, and they are effective. They help them stay awake when they probably should be sleeping, so much of what we see related to methamphetamine has a lot to do with non-pharmacological factors like poor lifestyle choices that people make. They don't eat well, they're not sleeping well, they're not taking care of themselves. They would be doing this probably despite the fact that they're using drugs. And so we attribute some of these other things to drug effects when in fact they're not drug effects.
Now, what about the reports, and again, these are anecdotal, not scientific, from law enforcement officers, that when they try to subdue and take into custody someone who is high on meth, that these people can be, you know, almost like a rhinoceros, resistant to physical force, kind of oblivious to tasers and other non-lethal approaches. How does that reconcile with the science, Doctor?
Yeah, so again, the bottom line for that is that there is no evidence to support that. But what I'd like the listeners to think about is that, let's go back to 1914. There was a report in the New York Times called Negro Cocaine Fiends Are a New Southern Menace. And the things that you just described about methamphetamine were basically said in this article about black people who were snorting cocaine. This was now the new form of cocaine, the snorting of cocaine up your nose. And when these folks snorted cocaine, they were unaffected, supposedly, by .32 caliber weapon bullets. So the law enforcement officers made the argument that they had to shift away from the .32 caliber weapon to the .38 caliber weapon because that's the only way they could stop these people. And they were believed. Fast forward to, I guess, 1991, when Rodney King was severely beaten in L.A., the law enforcement officer said that they believed he was on PCP, which gave people superhuman strength, supposedly. Of course, it's not true. And so they felt like they had to really beat him so severely because he was on PCP. He couldn't stop otherwise. He was, of course, only on alcohol. So these sorts of stories about drug users developing superhuman strength, they're not new. These are the same stories that are recycled from generation to generation. And law enforcement officers are not the people that you really want to hang your hat on in terms of being factual about this stuff.
Well, you also point out that they're often the lead parties in drug education, which is part of the problem that we have of recycling hysteria and ignorance as opposed to honest information.
Now, there have been few efforts that have had more of a negative impact on public health education than the one you just described.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is it's often fueled by funding that is derived from the confiscation of property and money and other stuff from drug dealers. And when they get these kitties of disposable cash, I find that really dangerous because we have no idea what they actually do with that. And when we do learn some of the things they do with it, it's to promote disinformation or the kind of hysteria that we've been talking about. Dr. Hart, the most widely abused drug in America today and the one that is leading to the most, I believe, emergency room visits is hydrocodone. And that is under the brand name OxyContin, and also people know it in a lesser strength, Vicodin. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that, because this is the, when we look at the war on street drugs, this is a highly addictive and potentially dangerous a pharmaceutical drug that is not, concocted or cooked on the street in any way. It all comes from the pharmaceutical companies that have the patents to produce this stuff. And so it speaks to the limits on our efforts to use systems and laws to control human behavior in this regard.
Well, I want to correct some here. And first of all, I should preface my remarks by saying that I am no sort of proponent of what pharmaceutical companies do. They do what they do. That's number one. But number two, the most widely abused drug, a psychoactive drug, is by far alcohol. Hmm. So if we would include the alcohol numbers in the emergency room sort of visits, it would overwhelm the data. So
yeah.
They don't include alcohol alone.
Mm-hmm.
And when we think about oxycodone or OxyContin, it is actually a good thing that people would use that as opposed, because OxyContin and those sort of opioids are similar to heroin. It's better. I would much prefer that people use those drugs than using street heroin, in that at least we know that they will be getting a pure pharmaceutical-grade compound, and that will decrease some problems, because many of the problems we see related to illicit drugs are mainly related to the fact that they contain adulterants, and the adulterants themselves can be worse than the drugs themselves, I should say.
Yeah, good point.
So,
and by the way, I accept your correction about alcohol. It should be included in these, but our thinking is often shaped by legal, illegal, and alcohol then is treated in a benign manner. Your point is well taken.
Yeah, and so, but when we think about the cases that do show up in the emergency room, it's important for the public to understand that most of the thing that we're really concerned about with those drugs is overdose death. And most of the deaths, 75% of the deaths that are caused by prescription pain pills like the ones you're describing, 75% are caused because the user combined those drugs with alcohol. So while people can get in trouble with these drugs alone, it's rare that you would see someone who used these drugs alone and in the emergency room. That's one point. Another major point is that many of the makers of these drugs put acetaminophen in these drugs in order to discourage the abuse of these drugs, because too much of acetaminophen can cause liver toxicity. Mm-hmm. The number one reason, the number one source of liver toxicity in the United States, in the world, is due to acetaminophen overdose. If acetaminophen was not in the medication and people didn't use them in combination with alcohol, many of these cases would just absolutely go away.
That's fascinating. Now let me turn to marijuana, cannabis, and we're seeing some movement. Public opinion polls show that most people want it to be decriminalized, and in states like Colorado and Washington, where we have forms of full legalization, the sky has not fallen. We don't have people, you know, who are abusing the newly found privileges. And yet the federal government insists on keeping cannabis as a Schedule I drug. This prevents any serious research into the benefits not only of smoked marijuana, but more importantly, of the cannabinoids that are in the cannabis plants that don't have anything to do with THC and the psychoactive properties of cannabis. And so I've talked to many people who've been studying this area, and it seems to show great promise for treatment of very serious diseases, up to and including cancer. Yet we're still, captive to the mindset of the 1930s about the demon weed and just, how dangerous marijuana is as a gateway drug. So there are a lot of questions rolled up in there, but feel free to comment on what you think is important about marijuana and the way we have attempted to control it.
Well, I mean, you point out some things about marijuana in terms of its legal status that certainly limits our ability to study more widely the drug. That's absolutely true, but we also should note that THC is available medically nationwide in a pill, and so people can get access to that. But I think that states like Colorado and Washington and the citizens of those places, I think what they're doing is incredible. I think that they should continue to put the pressure on. I think people like you should continue to speak about the hypocrisy. You know, when you say that we have some pretty serious illnesses like Dravet syndrome in children where they have these uncontrollable seizures, and CBD seems to, one of the compounds in the marijuana seems to help to deal with these seizures. And it's we should ask, why isn't this available for these poor kids who are having these seizures? Why isn't it more widely studied? I think that you're absolutely right.
So how do we break this? How do we get rational, particularly about cannabis? Because separate from the other drugs we've been describing, it has a lot of beneficial potential. And I feel that, in the interests of patients and in the interests of science, plus, trying to clean up our prison system and our clogged criminal justice system, the benefits of rational policies about marijuana cannot be understated.
Well, I think that we certainly have some movement. I think when you have a major news correspondent like Sanjay Gupta saying that he was wrong and he realizes that marijuana has these potential therapeutic benefits that he didn't recognize previously and he wanted to apologize. I think that we are really having movement on marijuana, but I want to make clear, too, because you said separate from these other drugs, there are beneficial effects of heroin. Mm-hmm. There are beneficial effects of methamphetamine, of cocaine. So I don't want people to not understand that those drugs, too, should be available.
I hear you. Yeah. My point is that that marijuana, even in situations where people call it habit-forming or abused, is much the side effects and the negative impacts are much less than most other drugs. And I do agree with you that heroin, as morphine, is a very important painkiller.
No, I mean heroin as heroin, not as morphine.
All right, explain how heroin as heroin is good.
Well, if somebody has dysentery and they have diarrhea, that could people can die from diarrhea.
Mm-hmm.
They should have heroin. That would definitely stop it. If they're in some excruciating pain, heroin is a painkiller. Heroin, it could, like people talk about marijuana, for example, helping them sleep better. Heroin, you can get some great sleep on heroin. I mean, so there are a wide range of potential beneficial effects associated with heroin, and there are also potentially negative effects associated with heroin, just like there are potentially negative effects associated with marijuana. But with the proper amount of education, we can enhance the potential beneficial effects and decrease the potential negative effects. And all I'm saying is that they're all pharmaceutical agents. They are all acting on the central nervous system, the brain, and they shouldn't be separated. Like marijuana is less dangerous than this drug. That's just not very smart. And that's how we've been looking at drugs throughout our society, because we say alcohol is not as dangerous as heroin, as dangerous as marijuana. When in fact, of all the drugs that you and I are talking about, the only drug that one can die from withdrawal syndromes associated with it is alcohol. That's the one that we have to really worry about if someone goes through withdrawal. We don't have to worry about people dying from heroin withdrawal. We don't have to worry about someone dying from marijuana withdrawal or methamphetamine withdrawal, but we do with alcohol. So at some level, alcohol can be considered the most dangerous. But we know how to decrease the negative effects associated with alcohol. We have plenty of education and experience with alcohol. If the same was true with cocaine, we would be able to use that in a more safe manner.
Very well said, and you're quite persuasive, Professor. Any chance you would consider taking the job as head of the ONDCP, the so-called drug czar? We need a rational drug czar in this country.
Not no, but hell no. You know, one of the things that I enjoy being is a free man. When you work for the federal government like that, you no longer represent yourself or the rational ideas. You represent the government, and you represent what people think the government should be. And sometimes what people think the government should be is not what it really should be. And so when people talk to so-called government officials and those people, they're not talking to people, they're talking to representatives.
Well, and you know what you speak of. You've had your own contact with the Office of National Drug Control Policy, and you've served on a number of boards that you left because they weren't committed to the science that they said, at least in their mission statements, they were committed to.
Yeah, so I'm just trying to be an honest person and trying to let the evidence dictate where my position lies, and that means that I will change my position from time to time.
Mm-hmm. Well, Professor, I don't want to impose further on your time. You've been very generous, and I just want to highly recommend your book, High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery that Challenges Everything You Know About Drugs and Society, and I appreciate you challenging me today.
Thank you very much, and I look forward to speaking to you more.
Getting rational about the war on some drugs? That's an idea whose time has come. My thanks to Dr. Carl Hart.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.